This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, and welcome to the second of three episodes on authoritarian neoliberal urbanism for Urban Political. My name's Gareth Fern. I work at the University of Manchester, and we've put together these kind of three episodes on the back of a special issue that we've edited for Urban Studies, that I've edited for Urban Studies alongside Guldum Ozatagan and Adair Radin, kind of trying to understand and discuss and analyse further, sort of turn towards what we can call authoritarian neoliberal urbanism, which will be available online by the time this podcast is released. The last episode, we focused on the sort of popular contestation of neoliberalism and the kind of more authoritarian populist kind of gestures that are made within that. So we've talked about how, you know, sectors of the public are mobilised in support of crackdowns on particular groups, or how political leaders make use of kind of populist gestures, which target the more quote unquote and scare quote progressive aspects of neoliberal policy. What I want to do in this episode is get more into these kind of particular practices that have been sort of established and enabled by that kind of popular gestures and rhetoric. So, you know, the practices that urban and regional governments are actually enacting, right? So there's a kind of an important scale of question straight away, right? Immediately, like national governments are sometimes kind of taking on directly urban governance functions, local government functions. We're kind of seeing new kind of para-state, I guess, or sort of pseudo-state actors or emerging to kind of navigate these contexts from below. And there's also kind of global shifts in sort of political economy and geopolitics as well that are changing how cities, governments operate in competition with one another. So there's a real question of power, who and what is leading urban government politics, how much autonomy does the city have to pursue alternative directions when central governments are exercising and expanding these powers, the cities become places of resistance. I do also need to think a bit about the practices themselves. Some of them, the practices we're talking about, are like overtly draconian, such as like, police, the heavy militarized policing of protests, like we're seeing in the US and recently also in Turkey as well. Targeting of, migrant groups, things like this, which are very explicitly, violent. And these gain a lot of attention, quite rightly, and the real visible displays of the power of the state and the tests of legitimacy it's facing. This kind of tension between city and federal government about how urban space should be policed. Maybe sometimes it's only a matter of degree. But there are also other changes in practices too, right, which amount to kind of removing lines of accountability of governance, right? So the political scientist Glacius calls this sabotaging accountability, which he thinks is at the core of kind of authoritarian politics. Not just for those in political power, but also kind of key economic actors too. So like developers, high value industries, nationally supported infrastructure projects. And perhaps one reason we're seeing this kind of sabotage across different contexts, across different places, is the kind of crisis of legitimacy of kind of neoliberal policy, right? That things like deregulation, privatization are in failing to meet the needs of more and more members of the population, right? And this sort of overall kind of approach is struggling for legitimacy. So to help me discuss this, I've got four distinguished guests, which I'll introduce now. So we have Nitin Bhatla, the postdoctoral researcher for the dual affiliation at University of Zurich and ETH Zurich. Alki Jens, who is the senior researcher and head of the research cluster on contested government at the old Bergstrasse Institute in Freiburg. We also have Sven Daniel Wolf, who's a lecturer at the Spatial Development and Urban Policy Group at ETH Zurich. And soon to be professor of social and cultural geography at the University of Neuchâtel. And last but not least, we have Ebru Kurt Osman, urban geographer, recently awarded a PhD from the University of Amsterdam. So welcome and congratulations, Ebru. So thanks obviously to everyone for being here. I think the first question I think will go to Ebru, because we're recording, as I sort of touched upon then, we're recording against the backdrop of large-scale protests, not just in the US, but also recently in Istanbul. Which has seen some mass arrests, the incarceration of the main opposition challenger to Erdogan, who is the Istanbul mayor. And, this is not a new thing. The Istanbul has been the site of like protests for quite well over a decade. And the Gezi Park protests and over 10 years ago now, which were challenges to Erdogan, that saw similar sort of light levels of arrest and sort of militarized policing, etc. And it's important that these kind of protests then started because of an urban development plan, right? As far as I understand it. So, and this became a challenge to kind of the AKP's government. So I kind of want to start with you, Ebru, if you could kind of explain and introduce the kind of role of urban policy development, Istanbul, and its kind of contesting of Erdogan's rule, both, you know, recently and over the last few years.
Thanks, Gareth. Yes, the question is highly timely, especially in light of the current mass arrestments following protests in Istanbul, as you mentioned, including the imprisonment of the Istanbul's elected mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. He is the most significant opponent figure in Turkey right now. But to understand this development, as you mentioned, we need to go back to how urban policy has been instrumentalized under Erdogan's rule. When the ruling Justice and Development Party, AKP, came to power in the early 2000s, in 2002 exactly, Turkey didn't have a functioning, proper legal urban transformation framework. And this party, AKP, effectively created one. It was initially, of course, presented as a solution to urban development, housing accessibility, urban decay, and so on. And it was, of course, supported by growth-oriented promises, relevant narratives, and social welfare discourse. But over time, especially since the late 2000s, 2010-2012, we witnessed a centralization of planning powers. This centralization has brought together sidelining local governments and democratic checks. And it indeed created a path-breaking trajectory. This is how we call the trajectories of change as a result of critical junctures in one of my published research. So it marked a key conjunctural shift from entrepreneurial governance toward authoritarian, but still entrepreneurial, but still governance, because the, you know, the frameworks are there, some democratic channels are still working. So like toward authoritarian entrepreneurial governance, that was the how the shift, you know, move forward to the next one, next level. And this is not my specific case study, but it's I see it's important to mention this case because it's symbolic, Kanal İstanbul project, which is a state-led mega infrastructure project cutting through ecologically sensitive areas of the city. And the political message here is quite striking. I mean, for me, unbelievable, because like every opposition party mayor along the canal's proposed route has now been arrested. This is like very new for some reason, of course. So what we see is not just repression, but the instrumentalization and deeply politicization, even criminalization of spatial planning. So dissent is criminalized, urban development becomes a tool of authoritarian consolidation. So to answer your question directly, yes, urban policy in Turkey is no longer a natural field of technical planning. It has become an arena of political control and repression. And in my research, recent research, particularly my article on Fikirtepe Urban Transformation Project published in Urban Studies in the spatial issue, I have explored how regeneration projects reflect this dynamic. I mean, these are not simply about urban renewal. They are embedded in a governance model where state, market, legal frameworks converge to push through speculative transformations. And residents, in this sense, residents are marginalized, yet paradoxically, some also adapt by mimicking entrepreneurial behaviors, a phenomenon we call entrepreneurial citizenship. And it shows how authoritarianism doesn't eliminate agency, I mean, not totally, but channels it into a survivalist but way, like also often opportunistic modes of negotiation. And we see this across Istanbul in places like Fikirtepe, Derbent, based on my research, where citizens are compelled to act like developers to protect their homes, to secure their profit. And in these cases, informal brokers emerge. They mediate deals between communities, private actors. Perhaps we can I can open up this discussion later. But it's not just the state repression, but a complex regime where authoritarianism and entrepreneurialism feed into each other. They also reshape both the governance structure and how communities engage with this structure. And more broadly, this reflects what we define in our research like as authoritarian entrepreneurialism, which is a dynamic, adaptive mode of governance that fuses state dominance, market logic, and making populism legitimate or post-populism. we call it post-populism in our context. And it's, of course, heavily top-down, but constantly reconfigured through spatial struggles, legal forms, everyday negotiations. And this is precisely why Istanbul's urban space remains as a key battleground, not only for Erdogan's consolidation of power, but also for ongoing contestation from below, from bottom.
Thanks, Ebru. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, from your paper and your writing, and obviously what you just said there as well, I think you've done a really good job of showing that the kind of entrepreneurial neoliberal kind of aspects of policy are really intertwined with kind of this kind of authoritarian kind of action, right? And I feel like, it's important just because I guess if you think of some sort of mainstream political discourse, particularly in like, I'm thinking about, I guess, maybe a bit more of the US, it seems to treat like authoritarian kind of politics as some sort of like accident or, you know, some sort of like mistake, mental error or something, rather than like being really deeply intertwined with these kind of material development kind of processes, particularly as you get in the examples you gave. So that's really interesting. I think, and to move on, and I think was like some kind of parallels as well with India and the way that you've done it in as well, in terms of this clear kind of developmentalist kind of connection to like authoritarian kind of politics. And yeah, that's been very important for like Modi and this sort of Hindu nationalist kind of power in India. So your work's kind of highlighted particularly the role of like infrastructure development, I guess similar to the sort of one of the examples that Ebru just highlighted, particularly in urban peripheries, highways, and that's, you know, been a kind of part of expanding what is known as the Gujarat model, which Modi developed when he was chief minister of Gujarat, and expanding a more neoliberalized kind of approach to development across the nation. So I guess it'd be good to maybe start with how this model kind of breaks from previous regimes of urbanization and development, and then like how this then brings in or modifies or expands authoritarian kind of practices.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks also for organizing this very pertinent conversation under the current geopolitical climate. I think it's a very sort of pressing conversation, and I'm so glad to be part of it. And also, after a very long time, to be on the other side of the podcast, not as a host, but rather as a speaker, because I've hosted tons of podcasts by now, but I never get invited to podcasts, so I'm so happy. But also, I just sort of like wanted to latch on to what Ebru just, very beautifully highlighted, you know, this sort of like this, what I call authoritarian urbanism beyond the city, this sort of like, you know, the authoritarian urbanism that unfolds along these mega urban corridors or mega infrastructure corridors. And that's something that one sees also in India, you know, as you, Gareth, just sort of sketched out, like, you know, with the demolitions that go hand in hand and are sort of unconstitutional and, you know, sort of override power alongside, you know, the construction of highways and, you know, port projects, all of that in India. I wanted to make a quick digression and, you know, sort of bring an autobiographical note on explaining to the listeners how this sort of what is known as the Gujarat model of development or the Modi model of development, you know, came into place. I have a very personal connection to it. It was 2001 when my parents moved to Gujarat, when Narendra Modi was the chief minister, had just become the chief minister of that state. There was a huge earthquake and my parents were working with the relief efforts and sort of like post-disaster redevelopment. And at that time, we were living in the city of Ahmedabad. And in 2002, as I was a school student in Ahmedabad, riots broke out, and there were huge, massive riots spoken about as Hindu-Muslim riots. And but it was a state program essentially led by a lot of like political activists from Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party. And it was a program against Muslims in the city. And I had a very lived experience of that, living amidst those riots and those mobs. And it was a very decentering experience to witness that. I would get very frantic calls from my classmates who were Muslims and, you know, were really experiencing those. And we would have, like, you know, we were basically sort of like, you know, locked into our homes and, you know, told by people, well, there are these Muslim mobs that are coming out for us, and we should, you know, be prepared. There were no Muslim mobs out there. It was basically, you know, just a state-sponsored program. But what it did was it divided, it drove a wedge in the urban fabric of the city, you know. So people started to believe that Hindu and Muslim parts of the city are different. And, you know, in the aftermath of the riots, there was a huge segregation in the city. So people really started to stop intermingling, you know, the syncretic fabric of the cities really started to fall down. And what was different that we felt as someone who had lived in Delhi and other parts of the country is that riots do break out on a smaller scale, but there's a sort of post-riot reconciliation where, you know, there are attempts to reconcile the rioting sort of, you know, groups and to sort of, again, in a very liberal post-colonial way, sort of, you know, reconcile the city into some sort of, you know, cohabitation, a form of cohabitation and living alongside each other. What happened in Ahmedabad was that reconciliation project never happened. So there was no reconciliation. There was a further wedging of the society. There was, and this went hand in hand with, you know, the first greenfield models that started to come up in the peripheries of Ahmedabad. So, you know, this sort of like world-class, aspirational, neoliberal, you know, smart cities like Dholera Smart City, the redevelopment of the riverfront of the city, you know, other kind of redevelopment projects. So, you know, it became a sort of calling card. Like, people were initially in other parts of the country were very appalled by what happened in Ahmedabad and how, you know, horrible it was in terms of, like, in the polarization of the society and, you know, this sort of really a new form of worlding emerging, which really departed from this non-aligned movement, you know, kind of liberal post-colonial order. But then people started to see it or understand it as a spectacle. So Narendra Modi would organize, you know, these sort of diasporic meetings where people from, you know, the Gujarati diaspora from the United States would come with the financial capital to Ahmedabad and, you know, sort of invest in these projects. And he started to be seen as this sort of like, you know, model of new India, shining India, a sort of like world-class city making, a world-class world making, you know, a sort of leader who could bring, who could neoliberalize India in a new way, in a way that departs from, you know, the liberal model of development. So in that sense, you know, my embodied experience of living in Gujarat was that it was not neoliberalism that we were living under. We were living under a form of illiberalism. So it was very illiberal. It was very authoritarian. So, you know, sort of like me growing up, you know, going to the university and sort of becoming a researcher, starting to research other parts of the country where, you know, this sort of like space-time of authoritarian neoliberalism or illiberalism arrived a bit delayed because Modi became the Prime Minister of India in 2014, and it took him a while to really start overriding and, you know, sort of selling that hatred and, you know, developing those wedges. I know I've taken up a lot of time and I want to bring this to a sort of like quick conclusion, and I'm happy to talk about it later, pick up on it later. But just sort of like, you know, fast forwarding to 2025, May 2025, just last month, there was a sort of like skirmish slash war between India and Pakistan. And you would not believe the biggest casualty of the war was not at the frontiers or through fighter jets. It was through evictions. So Ahmedabad again witnessed huge evictions. Almost 10,000 families were evicted in Muslim majority neighborhoods of the city on the pretext that it was done for national security, that these people were illegal Pakistanis, illegal Bangladeshis in the country. There's been a sort of aestheticization of like the Muslim other as this alterity that does not belong to New India, that does not belong to the space-time of, if one can say, neoliberal urbanism that India is churning out. So that is sort of the state and the bind that we find ourselves in India today. And what's perhaps common with what Evru said, it's a very different form of world view, world making, where, you know, the sort of like religious polarization works out in another way. But there's a sort of like kinship as well in terms of, you know, the politicization of this sort of world making. That, you know, Modi casually hangs out with, you know, people he really identifies with Bibi Netanyahu, with Viktor Orban, with Putin, with Donald Trump, with all kinds of leaders that he identifies that model with. So there's a slow world making that is unfolding that is perhaps more than neoliberal, that is perhaps illiberal, that I would like to explore later on with the other speakers.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. And yeah, I think that's really really important. And also in the next episode we talk a bit more about liberalism, but I think we should also talk about it today in this. You know, I think if we're making a distinction about neoliberalism, there is a kind of distinction in both academic writing, I think also the writing too, of like the kind of sort of 2000s-ish, it's different in different parts of the world, but that kind of zenith of like what in the UK is called the third way, the kind of internationally was like good governance, all those kind of discourses, right? That was kind of almost like the peak of a kind of soft and progressive, and I use that term very loosely, kind of neoliberalism, and that's kind of been decisively rejected by, yeah, all of the people you just named. I mean, I think Modi was on like a CIA blacklist or something, wasn't he, when he was like CIA, when he was the leader of Gujarat. So like to then become a, you know, celebrated world leader, I guess, by America and others, like kind of, I guess, almost highlights that shift in like at least discursively, even if there wasn't really too much different under the surface, but sort of globally. But anyway, I think that we can move on then, or the next question will be for Alki in terms of, which draws upon some of the similar, I think, issues to what both Abhir and Nitin have talked about. Thinking particularly of her work on Oaxaca in Mexico, which again deals with, I think, a kind of issue of center and periphery and the use of kind of more coercive and authoritarian practices for peripheral residents, and again, kind of on kind of class and also racial lines as well. For more peripheral residents, you know, for the sake of developing perhaps that high-end kind of real estate in the center. What I thought was interesting is how you make the link between authoritarian practices and kind of competitiveness. So I just maybe it'd be interesting to talk a bit about Oaxaca and also how competition relates to this kind of authoritarian kind of urban type of buildings.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And what Nitin and Evru said actually really resonates. So I think we'll have lots to talk about. I'll try to keep it relatively short. So obviously, when you think about competition, we might think of it as in the classical political science sense, right? Competition between political actors, and that's good because then they compete for votes and they alternate in power, etc. But I look at this from a more political economy and maybe political geography perspective, and with cities striving for competitiveness, I mean a discursive and practical shift that I observe probably in the 2010s mostly. And these are discourses in urban development and modernization. They're advanced by multilateral organizations, donor agencies, and so on, development banks. And they were actually, the region I work on mostly is Latin America, and these programs were keenly adopted by national and local authorities, and they have structured much of urban policies in Latin America. And what they do is they champion liberal democracy, economic liberalization in the city, technocratic management as guiding principles for cities to tap into the opportunities of globalization. And I think that's maybe also what's sort of new, right? Cities themselves or city governments themselves try to garner the attractive side of, you know, they want to get investment and so on. That that also means that poverty or inequality or even violent conflict are sometimes seen as results of just not good enough market integration and so on. And what this allows you to see, or I feel allows me to see, is the multi-scale setup of power relations and the multiplicity of actors involved, right? So it's not just the mayor or economic groups in town, but it's quite obviously state and also transnational actors' power that are manifest in the city. And that translates into spatial setup as well. As you said, with the center, and my work on Oaxaca in Mexico is based on the city being included in competitive cities programs, like state programs that were given out or written down in the 2010s. And they are, so on the one hand, it's sort of a specific program that tries to make Oaxaca competitive for international investment. On the other hand, it means austerity. So Heck's classical idea of austerity urbanism, right? Downward pressures on municipalities. So they avoid spending their budget and at the same time attract investors. And in Oaxaca, they did precisely that. So it's a lot of entrepreneurship around cultural tourism, enlisting indigenous communities in these folkloric experiences and so on. But it also meant that both funds that aim at enhancing competitiveness and also safety provisions have enormously privileged the city's historical center. And it means that a lot of other places in the city are left behind and are, well, sort of selectively made more insecure as a result. And it also means that in the city where a lot of money is invested in painting and making the streets look pretty and so on, and I've been a tourist also in Oaxaca, I can't sort of distinguish that completely from being a researcher there. It's wonderful to travel there. But at the same time, this obviously means rise of property value, price hikes in selected neighborhoods, and people in other neighborhoods that are really experiencing the downsides of this trying to be a competitive, wonderful tourist city. This has deepened the spatial inequalities. For example, you can imagine gated communities contrasting with lower class neighborhoods where there's, well, no public transport or anything. It's authoritarian in the sense that there's little inhabitants can do to change this. Competitiveness rules out other priorities. And the state's propensity to employ coercion, as you also say in the special issue, is manifest much more in the urban than before, I think. For example, informal vendors are driven off the streets of the center because they are deemed to be too chaotic, even insecure and so on. And maybe something that is specific, and I don't know if you have that in the work that you do, there's in Oaxaca, there's both the municipality and state institutions, sort of the regional administration. And that means there's a sort of a scalar manifestation of political power, different institutional levels that are present. State police is sometimes called in. So in Mexico, you have municipal police, state police, and some national operatives. And it's sometimes very confusing for outsiders. But the municipality of Oaxaca has called in state police sometimes. And then there's also non-state actors that participate in coercion that are tied to some politicians. And that is obviously very limiting to political protest in a city that has a very, very vibrant history of political protest, of being openly against the political power that is present in the city. Those open protests that have changed, they have changed a lot. So there's much less of that in the past decade, I would say, because the sort of so-called security of the rebranded city is an integral part of this competitive rationale. Parts of the city are made safe, others are left behind. And this conjunction has reshaped insecurity for a lot of people because the state turns against them, etc. And then to echo what Nitin said, this also goes beyond the city. I don't know if you've heard of the mega infrastructure projects in Mexico, but there's an idea of cities not so much as places of political encounter, but rather cities plugged into logistics corridors, on the whole, like in a very grand scale. And I think we have to sort of bear that in mind as well when we study this.
Cool. Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And yeah, again, I think, yeah, as you mentioned, there's some clear kind of connections with the work that both in a brief point out too, in terms of I think through all three so far, that there's this clear linkage between this kind of economic kind of imperatives, or what's perceived as economic imperative, at least, whether that be competition, infrastructure development, housing, I think, and this kind of sort of insulation, I guess, of that power of the developer, of the state. I mean, these two things are often very well connected, right? Like, to distinguish the two is not always really that, you know, clear in some contexts. Like, yeah, but the state kind of insulating either a developer or its own sort of preferred kind of project, right? I just want to come to Sven Faniel now. And I think what's also actually interesting is that both the writers, both the people here, and also actually on the issue more widely, a lot of people have kind of taken a kind of ethnographic kind of approach to understanding the research, not just like a focusing, say, just on policy, focused in on, you know, what it's experienced and how it's a kind of authoritarian practice of playing out on the ground. And I think, Sven, your work, you know, does this in a very good way as well. And your work in like Belarus and Russia and Ukraine, sort of focusing on the kind of more everyday, I guess, of kind of authoritarian governance, the kind of policing, the checkpoints, borders, etc. So I guess if you could, maybe it'd be really helpful if you could sort of explain, you know, what it means to understand these practices as everyday experiences, particularly in terms of how this like limits or changes how people negotiate open space.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Gareth, and thanks, everyone. To me, I think, I mean, there's a lot to respond to with colleagues and friends here, what they've said, and my experience in the former Soviet Union. I think we could speak for a long time on how, well, there are really interesting parallels, but also ways in which the Russian, the Ukrainian, certainly the Belarusian experiences contradict or confound these other cases in Mexico or India Turkey. But to me, this idea of ethnographic experience, or really just a focus on the everyday, like really taking feminist methodologies and grounding the abstractions of geopolitics into the everyday or the embodied, the intimate registers, I think that to me is everything. And I think that that gives us ways in which we can make sense of these very disparate cases, and we can draw lines of commonality in between all of them. So to bring it down to earth, I think away from this, the danger of abstraction, which, I mean, we can all get into theoretical games and we all enjoy it to some degree, but really, I think a lot of the discussions in policy circles and academic circles lack the texture of everyday experience and these ethnographic research. I mean, I think that my friends here have all demonstrated implicitly or explicitly the value of being on the ground and really experiencing what the lived reality of what it means to be in a space colored by authoritarian practices and authoritarian governance, and how that shapes the city. I think it's important to give light to the very basic but very fundamental ideas of positionality here, because who you are colors how these authoritarian structures affect you. And they shape where you can go physically in space. They shape what happens to you as a researcher. It shapes the kind of questions that you can ask with what contexts. So, you know, your skin color, if you're not the same skin color as the dominant skin color in the place that you're researching, that's going to color it. And the way that you speak, you know, are you from there? Can you pass? And this exposes you, I think, to different risks, but also different opportunities for asking certain questions. You mentioned in your question, Gareth, about governance and policing and checkpoints and borders. And what I'm increasingly interested in, actually is not so much like a physical border in space, which are, of course, policed militarily and increasingly so, but the more invisible borders that demarcate what you can and cannot do. And there's a temporal aspect to this, too. And so if you look at the Russian case, there was a time in the not too distant past when Russia was a lot freer. And you can measure that by how you yourself acted and how, you know, what people themselves were allowed to do. Could you go out onto the street? Yes, you could. Could you register discontent against the government? Yeah, for sure. In different capacities, in different registers, it's never been like a paradise for free expression. But in comparison to what's happened since Vladimir Putin's, you know, third and fourth forever terms, it was an entirely different country, you know, 15 years ago. And the question is what that looks like, both in terms of, you know, for me, the most important thing, everyday life for the human beings living there, but also for what kind of questions we get and how we can make sense of that at larger scales. So, you know, we've all been talking about patronage networks and mega projects and legitimacy, and those things all definitely apply to Russia. But I would like to, you know, contribute to the conversation just by asking the very basic question, like, how do you make sense of that? How does an ordinary person on the street make sense of, you know, what is a patronage network, you know, look like? How do you experience that at a human level? In the Russian context, you could say, in the broader framework of, you know, a grand, internationally prestigious mega event project, you know, preparing for the Men's Football World Cup 2018, happened in 11 cities across Western Russia, and you know, a very top-down development structure. What Alke was saying about informal traders being swept out of sight because they don't sort of fit the paradigm of what a modern city should look like, that definitely applies. But, you know, aside from your access to informal traders, what does it do if you're not even particularly interested in the mega event that's being hosted? Well, it could look like the minibus taxi service, which, you know, if you've spent any time in the post-communist spaces, they have these minibus, or they used to have these minibuses that ran around everywhere to fill the gaps in traditional, say, bus service, which all went to pieces after the fall of the USSR. And these were run, some of them more shady than others, some of them quite wonderful. Oftentimes they're driven by minorities within the sort of Russian federal structure. But they don't look fancy. Oftentimes they're sort of run down and shambolic, and they don't fit the image that power wants to project, and yet they're extraordinarily convenient. They run and take you where you need to go. So what it looks like from an everyday perspective is that there's a minibus taxi service that suddenly disappears from the urban fabric. You don't have any say in this; it just disappears, and then it's replaced by a bus, a new, very fancy looking bus, you know, Chinese made buses, European made buses before the full scale war against Ukraine. You know, there was a great valuation on, you know, so-called European quality. And the mayor and the governor, who don't really have any power, they're all appointed by the federal center, by Putin and the like. But still, there's the image, the trappings of power. They would be introducing this new bus to great fanfare, and it gets spread throughout the local media, which of course isn't free. And the image is, hey, look how modern we are. And then, of course, after the spotlights are off, that bus service doesn't really run as promised. Maybe it comes once an hour, maybe not at all. It's uncertain. And the end result for you is that your minibus service has been taken away. There's a great new modern bus. You know, it might have air conditioning, but the air conditioning is never turned on. It's promised to connect all areas of the cities, but it doesn't actually do it. And so for me, I think one of the functions of, or not functions, one of the effects, let's say, of these authoritarian practices is that there's a great number of people left out. And so this ethnographic view and the view on the everyday that I am increasingly concerned with is an effort to bring to light those forgotten people and places and try to give them a voice, because it's quite easy to neglect that sort of smaller but not less important scale. So I think I will leave it there, although there's a lot that we could take up, but I also am cognizant of the fact that I'm not the only voice here. So thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. That was really interesting. And I think, yeah, actually something that maybe came up one of the other purposes as well is that kind of aesthetics of what this... or what of like a kind of aesthetic sign of kind of authoritarian urbanism, I guess, in this kind of idea of the clean and modern place, clearing out space, cleaning it, making it look shiny, and things like this, right? Sometimes even just concreting over like annoying like pits of grass or greenland or green space, whatever, just all these kind of things got feeding into this. But also that being explicitly connected with like control, right? And like surveillance and things like this, like in a very clear and obvious way that when you physically alter a space in order to, you know, the what seems like maybe a small aesthetic intervention comes with like new surveillance cameras or something like this, right? All those things kind of getting like mashed together. And then obviously that really affects, I guess, people's personal experience and how they behave as well, right, as a result. So I think maybe there's like kind of like three questions I think have kind of come from these discussions that we can focus on, or three issues, all of which have the same letter to start with, which is very neat. But I think there's like this question from of kind of like intermediaries or like kind of like, yeah, so intermediary kind of groups and actors that are sometimes replacing the state, sometimes there wasn't a state there anyway, but they're like taking on what we might think of as state functions, or those people that are being promoted by the state, which are not necessarily just elites, right? Like it can be like more intermediate. That's why I use it with intermediary. Intermediaries both in an economic sense, but also intermediary groups of people, whether that's caste or class kind of groups. And there's also a question of like whether the two related questions, I guess, of like the extent to which these practices are like kind of like the way they're being deployed to like insulate power, particularly economic power, but also political power as well, as a way of sort of defense, as a kind of defensive thing, against dissent, against contestation, and as a means of limiting that. And I guess relatedly is like the, which is a kind of more historical question, I guess, of whether this is like, and then Nitin touched on this, I think, but is whether this is something like distinct or new, radically distinct and radically new, or whether it's an intensification of things that have been happening for kind of decades in terms of, I guess, neoliberal policy being kind of very anti-democratic from the outset. And is this just like, this is a kind of almost logical conclusion of this kind of process, especially when we think of how things like trade unions, for example, are undermined by these kind of political leaders. So I guess we'll start with the intermediate question, maybe Litton. Yeah, I was thinking particularly of how in both of your work you talked about, so I'll go to Ebru first, but the how there's like a role in your work of like kind of local entrepreneurs, I guess is the right word, or fixers who kind of take on this developmental role. You did talk about it in the intro, but maybe it's worth expanding on a bit. And this kind of like almost like seems to me like maybe in the heyday of neoliberalism, we have like public private partnership, or the NGO kind of took on this kind of role. But it seems like from what you're saying in the Istanbul case, you've got these more kind of like private individuals or small groups of people who are taking on this kind of, extra state, parallel to the state type kind of action to lead through kind of development. So maybe you could talk about that. And I think that in your work, you also talk about the role of the intermediary kind of caste groups in particular developments and their kind of privileging versus other groups as well. So maybe we'll get to you, Ebru, first, and then to Nitin. Sure.
I mean, thank you very much for all the input. I mean, unfortunately, there are like many parallel outputs, I mean, in means of the impacts of authoritarian regimes. And coming to this intermediaries, this meso level, let's say, actors in the Turkish case, I think they don't just reflect a weakened state. They are produced by the governance model itself. This is also have some similarities with the cases we discussed earlier. And especially in context shaped by the authoritarian entrepreneurialism, we see a mix of delegation, inaction, and deliberate ambiguity. That, of course, this also opens some space for these extra state actors to emerge, right? In my research, I studied two contrasting urban regeneration cases in my PhD research, actually, Fikirtepe and Derbent project. And in both, intermediaries played a crucial role, but the forms of entrepreneurial citizenship differed quite differed from each other. Like in Derbent case, for example, which is a lower income neighborhood, informal area, residents mobilized around defending their right to the city, like defending their housing rights was their priority, their proper rights, their collective presence. And here, entrepreneurialism was politically framed, like people created associations, institutionalized their self-organization, and developed legal and planning knowledge to negotiate with these local authorities, even under authoritarian strains. And their goal was not to profit, but to resist displacement and to defend urban citizenship claims under increasing pressure. And Fikirtepe, by contrast, was governed through intentional state withdrawal. The role of the state here was quite inactive on purpose. State left residents and private developers to sort it out, led to a speculative, of course, area. And the residents responded by acting like small-scale developers, cozy developers themselves, trying to maximize the value of their flats or plots. And in this setting, informal intermediaries emerged, which is called çantacılar in Turkish. We also call them like manipulators because they acted as unregulated brokers, like buying land from residents at low prices and reselling these plots to large firms for higher profit margins. And these figures exploit the gray areas left by the state's strategic absence, actually. And I mean, in terms of like public-private partnerships, I mean, this is not just a return to PPPs. I mean, it's more fragmented and volatile. It's a form of arm's-length governance under authoritarian conditions where the state selectively intervenes, as also Alke mentions, like there is this selectivity, I mean, selecting and on purpose, of course. Like the state is present when enforcing political loyalty, but absent when regulating profit-driven transformation. And interestingly, we now also see political intermediaries emerging, like opposition figures. I think we can also call them like this sort of political intermediaries, like planners, journalists, who act as connectors between imprisoned municipal leaders and civil society. I think this is a different form of this kind of actors. I mean, they are, of course, like formal actors in the legal process, but they also take on this kind of role. And these two is a response to authoritarian pressure, of course. When institutions are blocked, people step in to build new ones, and often informally. In short, intermediaries in Turkey operate not just in the cracks of the system. They are integral to how authoritarian entrepreneurial governance functions, and their roles reflect both the structures, coercions, and the population's attempts to navigate these gray areas and the conflicted areas as well.
Interesting. I thought that was really a good way of putting it, the how the state is active when it comes to enforcing like against dissent, but it's stands up
very,
when it comes
very,
to like,
yeah,
people.
Very there, very present, yeah. But other times, yeah.
That's the one a British theorist called Andrew Gamble, who wrote a lot about Margaret Thatcher in the '80s. Like one of the things he was well known for. He wrote strong state, free market, I think is how he described Thatcherism. Like, you know, the state's strong when it wants to be to police dissent, but it's it's quite laissez-faire when it comes to, you know, whichever privileged kind of developer, you know, capitalist it wants to do.
Thanks, Gareth. I just wanted to maybe zoom out and take a historical digression as well. In how neoliberalism has unfolded in India and on sort of like what ground it landed. So there's no constitutional right to land or right to housing in Indian constitution, but there's right to life. And that's a very strong right that can be interpreted to give rights to groups that enact informality, enact practices of squatting. That's a constitutional right that is quite open and flexible, that, you know, recognizes the right to shelter and to, you know, have a decent life. And that is something that was used always by non-governmental organizations and civil society groups to defend people who were being evicted and, you know, were on the receiving side of state development projects. Now, this sort of like model of civil society groups and non-governmental organizations continued to remain in the early years of neoliberalism. But this also meant that a lot of the, you know, this sort of neoliberal development projects, mega infrastructures, they were a lot of times resolved in courtrooms. So, you know, Gautam Bhan has written a lot about it. He calls it judicial urbanism. So that the site of master planning shifted to the courts, so to the judiciary. And the judiciary, you know, upholding a form of liberal post-colonialism in a legal way and, you know, kind of liberal social values, always was quite liberal towards squatting, people who were squatting land. And this meant that, you know, there was a sort of a compromise, but also a long-winded process, which meant that a highway project or a railway line would take 20, 25 years to complete. And in fact, I was working on one such road and I was looking at the everyday contestations and, you know, like the court rulings around what was happening. Now, what happens with, you know, this sort of Modi model of development taking root in neoliberal India is that there's a departure from that. In order to accelerate the change, in order to open new frontiers of land and new frontiers of neoliberal urbanism, there's two things that happen. One is the form of material incompletion that was very inherent to neoliberal development projects is presented as an eyesore, is presented as a sort of failure of neoliberal governance and, you know, form of judicial urbanism that was quite prevalent in India. There's a consensus around, you know, fast-tracking of projects, you know, like this sort of fast urbanism of, you know, rolling down and going through, you know, this sort of checks and balances of constitution and a judiciary. The second thing that happens is there's an alliance between, you know, the caste groups that benefited from the first waves of neoliberal urbanization in India that happens between, you know, the state power and these caste groups. Sai Balakrishnan has written about it. Tom Cohen, several scholars working on Indian urbanism have written about it. The first wave of greenfield development happens when the first neoliberal infrastructures come into place. They don't land on a neutral soil or a neutral territory, but there is a palimpsest of development, right? Like, so what happens when agrarian and urban politics mingle, right? Like, so there's a form of agrarian urbanism that has refractions of, you know, the class structure of agrarian class structure, agrarian institutions, and agrarian modernization, right? Like, so in India, the first wave of infrastructure projects land on places that had benefited a lot from green revolution, right? And these farmers who were the green revolution farmers who were already quite rich become real estate entrepreneurs, right? Like, who want to align with the state and help it open new frontiers of development, new frontiers of urbanism, new frontiers of infrastructure, right? What unfolds is that, you know, in the state violence of this sort of like, you know, demolition equipment coming in front of, you know, Muslim homes also outside the cities. So for instance, the place that I talk about, Nuh, which is, you know, a bypass region close to Delhi, the sort of like state violence is combined by the organized violence from these different caste groups. You know, that these entrepreneurs start to organize and align itself with the state. And so there is a sort of like erasure of the line between civil society and the state, right? Like, so the state starts to very closely and clearly align with certain caste and class groups in this sort of new wave of development.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. So I guess, I don't know, Alkif and Sven, if you want to come in on that, or I can move on to this next question of kind of insulating power from dissent, which I think kind of just follow from what Nitin just said there about how, and also Edbro as well, in terms of how local, these kind of more intermediary actors are sponsors of, leaders of, directors of, in some way kind of like directing or leading kind of what we could call authoritarian or just straight up just kind of violent kind of practices, right? That they, that, you know, through kind of identifying through the way they operate within the land market, I guess we could say, then kind of precipitates and leads to and connects with the way the state acts, both in a violent way, both in a kind of draconian way, but in a way that kind of sidelines kind of deliberation, I think, like what Nitin was saying there, over, you know, who gets to use land and what for. And I guess that relates to this kind of second question that I had, which is how, whether it's a mega project, whether it's housing, whether it's infrastructure, there's this kind of how we understand kind of contestation and dissent within this kind of emerging contest, right? So, you know, groups that are othered and displaced, but also, you know, explicit protesters and social movements, how can you, like, who are challenging political power in various different ways. And I guess there's this kind of overall kind of question of whether this like turn that we're talking about is like sort of just like locking in the winners or the leading kind of edges of kind of neoliberal development so far, like, you know, whether that's the privileged companies that you see in, say, India, or and the privileged developers you were talking about in Istanbul, like certain people have already gained prominence in the last 10 or 20 years and it's not insulating them from dissent, or as well as the political leaders themselves. Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is if you obviously you want to add something in terms of these intermediaries, but then also maybe also building into this question of how we see a kind of this authoritarian turn relating to sort of contestation and dissent.
Yeah, I'm going to link the two actually, because to understand contestation in, at least in Oaxaca, I think it's useful to look at the intermediaries question as well. So I have a piece in Urban Geography where I talk about how everyday practices in this whole context of competitiveness and insecurity turn political or more visible. But I do think that we have to look at the quieter, less visible practices to see dissent voiced, even if it's places like Oaxaca with a deeply ingrained history of open social protest. But with rising violence, homicides, and the authoritarian practices that people knew from before but have maybe transformed, there's a sort of an area which we have to look at, which tells us if something is happening actually, if people have discontent before we can see open protest on the streets, particularly in Mexico, where there are these escalating rates of violence since the mid-2000s. I think we have to understand that there's a blurry relation between the state and criminal actors, and it's not always easy to discern who is who. I would also very much agree with Ebru that this is not exactly a weak state. The default of neoliberalism is not the free market, but very much connected to a disciplining state. But I can say that in Mexico, there has been a transfer of competences and tasks towards police and military, rather than taking away from the state, right? There's like pushing funds into specific state capacities, I guess. Austerity and competitiveness policies didn't mean a lower police budget. But it also means that you have to know your way around the intermediaries that play a role in the city. So, for example, one person told me, and I would like to really to actually quote from that person, from the interview with that person, because it's so revealing. So this person was a municipal, he was an official, and he had his computer stolen. And so he went to the police and said, well, I need my computer back. The police said, we cannot do very much. And other people might just leave and say, okay, that's it, I'm not getting it back. But he would talk to them and says, this is indispensable. You have to acquire these non-official capacities. One knows there are official and non-official solutions. So I go and ask the policeman, those policemen, let's talk about this in private. And it turns out that the authorities themselves function as intermediaries towards the criminal group that had stolen his computer. So he had to go and ask that person, and the police provided the link. How much do I have to pay to get my computer back? So these are sort of the everyday practices that people talk about, right? And that tells us about contestation. So it's much more difficult in this context to actually openly protest. But one example that I think is very interesting in Oaxaca is dates a while back, and that was in the summer of 2017. People that were affected by the same kind of criminal group that had stolen this computer lived in neighborhoods, in the three neighborhoods around Oaxaca's landfill, where most of the waste goes. They became fed up with extortion and so on that they were experiencing. So there's everyday practices that they use to sort of shield themselves from this, but eventually they get together and block the access to the landfill, and the wonderful clean city center fills up with waste. And that's sort of, I think they really very consciously leveraged the political agency that they had to make the state act against a criminal group, which, because it wasn't acting in the city center, hadn't been important to state institutions. And then there were these connections to the police and so on. But that actually changed something for them. The sort of a liminal area between actual protest and trying to just, you know, organize your neighborhood life in a way that's feasible for everyone. So they get together and try and drive out these groups and act against and get together and try to avoid extortion and so on. But eventually they also demand something from the state, in this case, the municipal, the local state.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, cool. And yeah, Sven, sorry, Sima's got a question to pass on to you then.
Yeah, thanks very much. Alke, I found that really fascinating on both personal and professional levels. I'm also familiar with those kind of informal practices and these informal networks. And it's interesting. It's as though you have access to the VIP corridor in negotiating your everyday life. So just a quick illustrative example that resonates off of the computer story that you told me, which I thought was just really fascinating and hilarious and terrible all at once. In Russia, okay, so this is pre-Putin's third term, when things are still quite fluid, and you could, you know, various political scientists were calling it, you know, like hybrid authoritarianism or competitive authoritarianism. It's pre-consolidation, pre-kind of totalitarian direction, warmongering lunacy. So when you end up in Russia as a hangover from the Soviet period, as a foreigner, you have to register your arrival in every new city within 3 days. And then they liberalized that, so-called. They made it between, you know, 7 days or something. And this is to track your movements throughout the country. And it's extremely difficult to do so, or at the time it was. So you go to this, you know, the registration, the migration office, and there would be three windows, and two of them are closed, and a long line, and that feeling of just sort of bureaucratic weight in your body when you go in, you're like, oh, I'm going to be here for a long time. I had connections through no fault of my own at that time, and I waited, made a phone call. This is in the late 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s, and someone from the person from the sort of personnel door, you know, personnel admitted only kind of place, opened up, called my name, and I went behind the scenes, where there was a separate waiting room. Another man was there, and he was in a business suit. And we were offered tea and chocolates, cookies, while waiting, and we had personalized service for our registration processes. And the quid pro quo of this was the next day, I had to take the person who was my sponsor gave me a bottle of martini and a bottle of eau de cologne, and I had to deliver the bottle of martini to a certain man in a certain office somewhere and say, you know, with compliments from such and such a guy, and the martini was for this woman and the eau de cologne was for this man. And so I was shuttled around by a driver to say thank you for this favor. And after living in that environment for a number of years, it occurred to me that this is just what business is. It is this sort of suffusion of informal practices, patrimonial behaviors, or neo-patrimonial. I've also written about that kind of blends with this legal, rational, bureaucratic structure. So nominally, there is this rule of law. But really, we understand that there's this the way that things always are. And when you're living in there, you look at a more, say, Western model, you look at the West and think that it's hopelessly naive. There is no such thing as rule of law. Really, power actually always dictates. Connections really do always win out. And you're naive and foolish if you believe otherwise. And this applies directly, and thank you for letting me take the long way around, Gareth. This applies directly to the question about protest, because in many quarters in Russian society, there's an idea that protest or dissent is foolish. It's completely naive. When you try to stand up against power, if you have any chance of doing anything, power lets you know where things stand. And they've got a long tradition, long, terrible history that shows that they're actually quite right about this. When Putin returned for his third term, there were these massive nationwide protests. Millions of people took part in them, the Bolotnaya protests, they were called, around 2011, 2012. And they were repressed dramatically and unhesitatingly. And there has never really been a better chance to try to open up Russian society to actual political participation. So what Alke says about, you know, people, I think the phrase you used was leveraging whatever agency they have, that really strikes me very deeply, because there are, of course, Russians who live in Russia right now who have not fled, who do not support the government, who do not support the war against Ukraine, who do not support this direction that their country has taken in the last, you know, decade and a half, and certainly since 2022. But they have no means to express that in any meaningful way. When you're operating in a context, for example, Alexei Navalny was killed, and you know, many people have different opinions of him, but nevertheless, he was, you know, killed, and many people looked at him as an alternative kind of Russia, for better or for worse. There were spontaneous protests that took place all across the country, and what happened is that people, of course, are forbidden from saying his name, and you couldn't possibly show up with a sign. But all of a sudden, spontaneously, people all around the country gathered at the memorials for victims of political repression. These were installed in the urban landscape across the country, all the way from Moscow to the Pacific Ocean, in the 90s and early 2000s, to commemorate the victims of Soviet terror. It really did happen and was really, really horrible. So these markers, they're often quite beautiful and very emotional, you know, some sort of marble sculpture and, you know, like a hand that's, you know, reaching for freedom or something like this. And spontaneously, people all around the country just came to lay flowers at these sites all around Russia. And this came to be seen as an informal sign that, hey, we do not approve of this state murder of this alternative voice. But I spoke online to some people who are deeply anti-government. And, you know, we're on encoded channels in order to communicate, because digital surveillance is a thing. And I said, so are you going to go lay a flower at the memorial? And they laughed. They said, do you think I'm stupid? I mean, there's video surveillance of this thing. Like, you just watch and see. And sure enough, before too long, the state started rounding up people who had laid flowers. So you're getting fined and imprisoned, or worse, for the act of laying a flower. And the people are not foolish. They understand that there's nothing really to do except keep your head down. So I think it's you know, in the Russian and the Belarusian contexts, it's very easy to homogenize the groups, and it's very easy to focus on the view from outside and show how you know, this state is all, you know, united behind this you know, lunatic Putin and his bloodthirsty war. There are many people who really aren't. And they have no adequate voice to say so. I mean, that said, there are, of course, bloodthirsty lunatics who are way into the state project, just as there are, I mean, in my birth country, in the United States. And I share this with my Russian colleagues and friends, this sense of just kind of just bafflement. We look at our country people and just wonder what sort of zombie process has taken them over. And I think one of the takeaways from this conversation you know, that I'm going to have is, this is not just only to do with Russia and the United States, but this really seems to be a global phenomenon, the sort of wave of madness and zombification that somehow legitimizes violence and expropriation and somehow does it all under the waving of a flag. And the real question is there anything meaningful that we can do to stop it? For my part, I looked at the No Kings protest in the United States, you know, where millions of people took part, and there's this feeling of, you know, potential change or whatnot, and it doesn't come to anything. And this reminds me very, very much of the Bolotnaya protests in Russia. There's a great sense of community, a great sense of optimism, and then it leads to nothing. And so I guess I would pose a question that doesn't have to be answered now, but what do we do? You know, we seem to privilege this idea that street protest does something, and it doesn't. I think it's important to do, but it doesn't seem to be connected to any kind of positive change. So on that really depressing but earnest note, I will be quiet.
No, I think that's really interesting. And I think actually I've seen in the UK, and I think also actually maybe in the US with the stuff in Los Angeles, there does seem to be an adaptation of activists to the state in terms of, like, actually, yeah, the sort of like A to B march being seen as like fine, but, you know, not consequential. And actually, if you really want to do something, you have to be more specific and targeted. So, like, they're trying to block ICE detentions in Los Angeles and New York, right? It's a very specific, targeted process where actually you're desperately trying to avoid getting arrested, and you're trying to avoid the authorities, but you're trying to cause a meaningful intervention. Similarly, in the UK, a group has just been prescribed by the government doing kind of direct action that interferes with an Israeli arms company that works in the manufacturers in the UK, right? And the government's chosen to try and prescribe them basically as a terrorist organization because they've actually been effective in stopping the production of weapons, basically, in the UK. But again, like, you know, that was like an adaptation to previous iterations of protest and clampdown. And
may I just dovetail real fast off of that, about the naming an extremist or a terrorist organization? There were tightening of laws in Russia before this latest couple of waves of crackdowns, where exactly the same strategy. To label an organization as terrorist or extremist is a really bad sign. Now, if you are, and I swear this is true, if you are a feminist, that is, like, feminism has been labeled as an extremist organization, as though feminism is a group, for one thing, but also if you espouse feminist beliefs, or if you call yourself a feminist, you are now by law vulnerable to prosecution, as, you know, and they're using this rhetoric of traditional values that they want to define and all or defend against the corrosive West and whatever. I am extremely discomforted to hear about this idea in the United Kingdom of labeling a group as terrorist. That sets alarm bells off in my post-communist context.
Yeah, well, I know, but also I think this kind of shows the antecedents of this in previous kind of waves of neoliberal development as well, right? Because the war on terror basically is where this all started in the UK, and it's been kind of ratcheted up more or less every year of my adult life since what, 2002, like the expansion of, you know, obviously starting with someone like Al-Qaeda and then moving, extending into, like, now a group that painted the side of a plane, basically. Like, so that kind of ratcheting up is something that seems to, yeah, every year or two, it seems to get more and more and more. I'm very conscious of time, so I wanted to kind of draw it together and maybe just go through it. I'll go back through our schedule on again. to maybe say one thing, but we'll just try and keep it a bit shorter. I guess the final point I kind of wanted to touch on was this question of, which I kind of just talked about that actually, is kind of intensification and kind of almost like what is we're trying to say is like novel about what's happening now, or is there like what is distinct or new about these kind of developments that you've all talked about? We've kind of all talked about or hinted towards some previous version of liberalism or some previous version of neoliberalism that has been modified, adjusted, even thrown away, right, in some cases. So I guess if we could, in a sort of short way, maybe say one thing or one particular thing that you think is really kind of setting out this kind of authoritarian urbanism from the past, and you know, things that we've touched on so far seems to be like the speed thing, this kind of thing of speeding up stuff. We need to speed everything up, we need to speed developments up, and that requires just ignoring democratic or deliberative processes, even constitutional processes, I think, or constitutional laws, or just law in general, I guess I should say. Yeah, the speed and intensity of urban development, legs, or whether it's whether it's just the sort of particular practices of policing or whatever. But any of these things, or even something else, like it would just be good maybe if I go around each person just to get like what you think is like the kind of most distinct novel shift that we're kind of trying, because we're all kind of saying there's been a bit of a shift. So I'd just be interested to, it may be a minute or two, you could say something you really think marks out the changes that you've seen in the last sort of decade or few years or something.
I think what we are witnessing now, it's not just a return to authoritarianism, as like all of us agreed, I guess, but the new configuration of it, because we are not only dealing with like urban conflict, urban development, urban gentrification, but also it is shaped by the pressures of global capital, migration crisis, climate crisis. And so it needs to be a crisis-driven governance to make it happen, this governing thing. Of course, it is, as we discussed today, this is not unique to Turkey. Like, there are very similar dynamics play out elsewhere, as we discussed today as well. So in short, the present moment is marked by adaptive authoritarianism, to my opinion. Like, it policies not just people, but territorial features as well. Like, who gets to live where, under what terms, and which promises of belonging.
I would just sort of like dovetail into what Ebru just said. If I would add something to the characteristics of what is new, perhaps, about, you know, the what we might understand as authoritarian neoliberalism, or I would even say it's a form of neo-illiberalism or illiberalism, is that there's not only erosion of a rule-based a global order, but also of a market-based neoliberal economy, that most of the decisions don't make sense. There's a lot of uncertainty and, you know, a lot of opportunism. But also, if I may add, a lot of kinship between the sort of like, as Sven Daniel was calling them, blood-hungry people across the world. For me, growing up in India, it was every time there was something in Palestine, one would like show a lot of solidarity to it. And now you see these sort of like blood-hungry mobs, you know, just showing solidarity towards Israel when it bombs people and civilians in Gaza, or, you know, sort of showing solidarity with Trumpians in the US, you know, kind of doing stuff against diversity initiatives, against Latinx communities. So there's a sort of like kinship, a new form of world making that is emerging. I must add, and this is the final point, I must add that, you know, a lot of academia is also complicit within it. A lot of people I see, my peers in Switzerland, have been completely silent on the war in Gaza. They haven't said a word, you know, and they are in positions of power and they're very comfortable, and they show only humanity towards when it's something against white people, you know. And I think that's quite the sort of like academia we've built is quite hand in hand with, you know, the sort of world making that is going on. So, which for me is quite depressing, actually.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very important point about academia. Also, I think how academia is, I certainly see in this country, being reshaped in the UK, I should say, in that there seems to be both from a kind of like repressive speech kind of perspective, but I think also like almost like an economic imperative as well. They want the universities to do STEM and not do anything political.
Basically,
they want to train engineers and do science and do maths, and that's good for the economy, and that's what we need. Which, you know, we do. I'm not saying we shouldn't train engineers, obviously. But like, you know, that's what university is supposed to do. And having people who are critical of government policy, or, you know, a feminist, or all these other, you know, the rubric they use at the moment is critical race theory. Yeah, that's the kind of word they've imported from the US. But like, there does seem to be that happening. And that's, again, something that's been happening for a long time, I think very slowly. But it seems that that's now aligned with this agenda, particularly around Palestine, of like troublesome academics, the ones that do speak out, and then which then reinforces a sense of people not wanting to say stuff as well, I think. So I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree. There's complicity, and there's also sort of this idea by some that we could be not political as academics and as social science people. It remains unclear to me how that's supposed to work, but there are a lot of people that seem to offer this perspective. And I wanted to add sort of another aspect. I would say that in global capitalism, urbanism has come to play a particularly active role as well. So the urban development projects are central to many solutions governments employ to tackle problems like different kinds of crises, surplus capital goes into urban redevelopment projects and so on. And some of these projects have allowed in some places to restore the high profit rates that sort of preceded the 28, 29 crises in Europe and so on. So I think that's something that sort of this connection to global capitalist processes is also something that we have to keep in mind. And these are markedly dispossessive and authoritarian. And then I think what we always have to do is, where does this hit most, and who is hit by it, and who is suffering these authoritarian practices most, right? Who is affected by urban displacement processes and so on? It's not even, you know, this is not something that's smooth or even, but it's a very uneven effect, and especially very much fragmented.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I completely agree. Sven, do you want to?
I will chime in very briefly also. I think that for me, what marks the change, this, you know, conceptual innovation that you're advancing, is this flavor of everything dissolving. Everything that was taken for granted, the idea that universities would be places where critical thought is allowed, the idea that colleagues would care about you or your people, the idea that there was such a thing as democratic functioning, the idea that solidarity exists and or matters and or can affect change. I'm not ashamed to admit that I am profoundly shaken over the last years, and increasingly so. The poly crisis, if you like, exacts a terrible burden, I think, on all of us. I have no problem admitting that it's rocked me and my family deeply. Our connections in Ukraine, our connections in Russia, our connections in the United States, our connections in the United Kingdom. It seems like the pillars of the world are dissolving. And I would like to believe in better futures. I still try to end my articles that, oh, we can, you know, recombine the assemblage towards better outcomes. And the more I say it, the more hollow it feels, if I'm being totally authentic, with me, with you and with myself. I have grown increasingly sad to see how easy it is to fracture those of us who should agree with one another, or agree with one another on 95% of the things, or on 85, or on 65% of the things, or on just one thing that, I don't know, human life is valuable and we shouldn't blow people up, right? And it's depressing to me to see how, like, natural allies in any kind of movement can so easily be split by, like, well, we might agree about violence, but what do you think about trans rights? And then you're like, well, if you don't follow my exact view, then, you know, to the camps with you. And while we're squabbling over terminology, the forces of power, the forces of capital, the forces of violence, they've won and they're consolidating their wins. And I don't know what to do about it. So this seems to me the biggest feature to me is that, not to be such a downer and end this podcast, but this might be it. You know, I mean, we are really up against the wall now. And each year we keep saying, well, if we don't fix the climate, you know, in the next deadline of X, then we're there. We might not even make it there. It might be, you know, nuclear apocalypse for real within the month. And I don't know what to do about that or how to function in my everyday life or how to serve my community or to serve my students. And so if you're asking what I think is novel, this seems to be that, this existential dread that is pervasive, that people are scared to talk about, but I'm not. And it seems to be increasing. And boy, oh boy, would I love to figure a way out of that. Thank you.
Yeah, right. No, I think I agree with what you said in terms of, sort of a general existential and feeling, which I think a lot of people, you know, feel on some level, even if they can't quite express entirely why, right? Yeah, I guess to bring it all together, then, I guess maybe let's try and inject some sort of optimistic or positive or like attempt to sort of think of a way forward, I guess, is that, yeah, I think what a lot of you said, and Alka actually really said it very well, actually, this kind of idea of, like, which we haven't talked about as much, but I think we talked about when we're going to talk about the other episodes, this kind of crisis and the role of crisis within driving some of these changes, right? Whether it's the financial crisis that led to austerity in the UK and US, or whether it's maybe the ongoing environmental ecological crises, right? Like, I feel like there's something, but maybe one of the limitations of this turn is that I wonder how much it can keep sustain both the antagonistic kind of politics and how long it can sustain not addressing some of these material problems for more and more people. Right. And I understand what we've said about how certain people are privileged and certain people not. And that, you know, I think that is sustainable for a period of time. But it does come to a point perhaps where if you keep growing inequality, if you keep, in India, you know, they're called jobless growth, right? Like, if you keep having these kind of processes where you're not actually, you know, middle class and working class life is getting degraded on such a regular level, like, that seems to me a sort of really tense political situation to manage, and you've got to be very astute and very smart to be able to do that. And I feel like that is perhaps where the kind of weakness of this sort of politics is that, you know, grievance will only get people so far, but if the world is getting warmer and we're having environmental consequences of that, and we're having ongoing housing problems, right, in the UK, so it doesn't matter, like, you know, we can talk about whatever particular target group it is this week in the news media, but if your rent's going up by £100 a month every month, then, like, that's going to make you do something. That could be positive, that can lead to reactionary and right-wing movements as much as it can to, like, progressive socialist or whatever movements as well. But I feel like within that kind of ongoing rupturing kind of crisis, there is some sort of opportunities if people can be organized and take them, and that's obviously a complex question for another day. But there's a kind of almost like an implicit kind of weakness of some of these authoritarian movements, right, that they realize that something's fracturing underneath them and they need to try and extend a kind of violent control, right? You know, they can't legitimate themselves through any sort of consensus or deliberate process. They have to. Okay, that's me desperately trying to find something good or positive to say.
I appreciate it, guys.
But yeah, thank you all very, very much for your time and for your participation. I've really found this very interesting, even if it's not the most sort of, you know, optimistic or positive story. I think it's an important story that we have to tell. And so yeah, thank you all. And we'll obviously, in the notes of the show, we'll have links to people's work and specialists about that as well. So if you want to read them, goodbye.
Thank you, Garrett.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.